minutes is up. 5 minutes is up. We will start the show with our vice chairman of REAP, who's stuffing his mouth right now. He will bring this meeting to order.
First, I'd like to welcome you all. Thank you for being a part of this nice forum here. We've got some great speakers. Certainly, water is always a topical issue for all of us here in Colorado. And so we look forward to an informative presentation and a great Q&A. So with that, I'll turn it back to Chip.
So again, Kip Shirotis is my name, executive director of something called the Regional Economic Advancement Partnership, REAP. Our organization brochures are outside for your education. We are an economic development organization that stretches along I-70, along that corridor, Watkins-Bennett, Strasburg, Byers, Deer Trail. We get involved in energy, transportation, education, health, infrastructure, but overlaying that is water. It's just the 800-pound gorilla on the eastern plains. The mission of REAP is to try to figure out, how do you do economic development in a aquifer-depleted landscape? Which leads us to our forum today. One of REAP's missions is to educate, to inform, to hold dialogue about the issues in the eastern plains that affect quality of life and economic development. Before I introduce the speaker, who is wicked smart, so get ready for her, I'd like to introduce and have Lynn Baca, Commissioner Lynn Baca, come up and give us a welcome. It is because of her you are in this room, free of charge, because we thought that this was something of an outreach attempt to get into Adams County. So, Commissioner Baca, thank you.
Thank you so much, Kip, and welcome everyone to Adams County. Our government center, this is our conference center here at the county, open to groups such as REAP. We host, as you can tell, we host employee trainings over here. Looks like nonprofits are across the hall. So it's been a great space to collaborate with partners and strategic partners and businesses and our school districts and internal staff and visitors to come and utilize the space. So really interested in the presentation today. Adams County, maybe you've not heard, part of my role as commissioner, I do represent District 5, which is Brighton, Eastern Adams, swings around and picks up the most northern communities in Aurora along Colfax. That is time, and I've actually talked to my commissioners of we need to start planning for Eastern Adams and what does that look like. And so we are also undertaking a water study. I don't have all the details of that. So mostly inventory, who are the special districts that we're playing with out there. And economic development is important. And it's important to plan, even if you may not implement that plan or it's 30 years down the road. And then the other big thing that I'm looking at is resources potentially needed in Eastern Adams County. It looks like we might have an opportunity with Bennett. So, for example, there's no 24-hour clinic or a clinic in Bennett. Some other things that we're doing an inventory of. What can we bring to Eastern Adams? Specifically, what services and what presence does Adams County have out there? Because I understand there is no presence of county services out there, DMV, getting your license plates. There's part-time hours out there, but it's really important that we have services in Eastern Adams County. So that's what I've been working on. So this presentation is very timely. So thank you, Kip. Always welcome to utilize this space. There is no charge. The board sees REAP as a very strategic partner. So thank you for having it here, and welcome to the speaker and to all of you.
Well, great. Thanks, Lynn. You're awfully hospitable. Okay, the format, the choreography for today, we will have a terrific speaker, followed by responders from Arapahoe County. Lynn, if you wish to pipe back with any comments from a Arapahoe County perspective on what you heard from our speaker, that would be the time to do it. Then we will have Mark Harding, once again, stuffing his face. sorry. Mark not only is a developer out in REAP realm, but he is also heads a metro district. So he's got water expertise from that sort of view. So the point, the objective today is to hear from the state, commented on by the counties, open it up for general questions and answers, and continue the dialogue, not just today, but in 2024. REAP would like to carry on in being some kind of an outreach communication forum facilitator for water issues. So we are super lucky to have as our speaker Tracy Kozla. Okay, she's an engineer by training, UCLA. Okay, she's a manager. Underneath her, she has 13 organizational boxes. 13! That's incredible. And she is also the communicator. She gets out to do things like this. She does seminars. She writes books. Go buy her books.
I don't have a book.
Well, you used to. Come on, you used to have. So she's the external person. So she's external, internal, academic, engineer. We have the trifecta of brilliance here today. So she's going to give us the state perspective on Eastern Plains aquifers today and tomorrow, and off we go. Tracy, you're on. Thank you.
Thank you. Clicker over here. That was quite an introduction. I don't know if anyone, including maybe the president, could live up to that, but I'll do my best today if I talk to you all. So I am a deputy state engineer. And so what does that mean? I work for the state government, and I work in part of the Department of Natural Resources. This may be helpful for you all to understand that at the state level, we have two water agencies, and it can be really confusing for the general public. So the first water agency, in no real order, is the Colorado Water Conservation Board. And the Water Conservation Board does a lot of things. I like to think of it very simply as really more the planning arm of your state government thinking about water. And then I work with the other water agency, which is called the State Engineer's Office, or the Division of Water Resources. And that's more your regulatory agency. The Division of Water Resources, for the most part, has a hand in directing what water users can use water in accordance with our system, when and where. And that includes both surface water and groundwater. So if you've heard of Colorado's priority system of water use, where senior water users, those with the older water rights, they're the ones that get to use water first in a time of shortage. When there's not enough water to go around, senior water rights get to use that water when there's not enough for everybody. So that's the very basics of this system. And here's our mission at DWR. We will administer the waters of the state to maximize lawful beneficial use, ensure that dams and water wells are properly constructed and safe, and provide information about water resources to the public. So here we are today. We're all sitting here in South Bend Basin. I put a little smiley face roughly on where we're sitting here, right in the middle, Adams and Arapahoe counties. These two counties right in the middle of the South Cut River Basin, in terms of both economic activity, as you all know, and water activity, there's a lot happening here in Adams and Arapahoe County and in the South Cut Basin. We have most of the people in the state of Colorado, right here in the South Cut Basin. We also have most of irrigated agriculture in the South Cut Basin. There's just a lot going on here. Colorado's agricultural counties, they are 9 out of 10 of the top agricultural counties that are located in the South Platte Basin. So agriculture is hugely important to the South Platte Basin. We're also located in a state where we have a significant imbalance between where the water naturally falls It's more concentrated on the west slope and where the demands for that water exist, which is on the east slope. Like I mentioned before, this is where our population centers are, and this is where we have the most demand for water for agricultural purposes. So naturally and geographically, we have an imbalance, just to begin with. We also have a lot of stresses and pressures on our water system. I know you all are aware of this. I'm not going to go into great detail, but you can imagine that we're facing a lot of changes with climate change. It's going to change some aspects of our hydrologic cycle. It's going to make our plants more thirsty. So we're looking at some future impacts from climate change. Another situation we have going on is with our population growth and our growing community, we have a lot of complexity that's being added to our water system. This other graph up here is showing the number of complex water cases that have been entered in the last several years in the South Platte Basin Water Court. And what these complex water court cases do is they divide up water into pretty small quantities, and it creates requirements for water leaving the system and when that water has to come back. Certain places, lots of different requirements. And so when we get these complex court decrees year after year after year, we're adding layer after layer of complexity on our water system. And so I just want to stress that we have a lot of complex stressors that we're dealing with, and the complexity is just growing, to be honest with you. So statewide and in the South Platte Basin, agriculture is the biggest water user by far. It can be surprising for many people that municipal water use represents less than 10% of water use in Colorado. So as we look for sources of reliable water for changing needs, there is a lot of senior and reliable surface water in agriculture that's potentially a source of water supply for our changing needs. It's helpful to understand that we can transfer irrigation water to other uses. The transfer of irrigation water to other uses, though, comes with technical and physical and sometimes permitting challenges. Oftentimes, if we're looking to do this as a source of reliable water, we're going to have to move water from where its point of origin is to where we need to use it. And I don't know if anybody read the recent New York Times article about the city of Thornton's water challenges and constructing a pipeline in the Poudre River. I don't see a lot of knowledge out there, but it's just an example of where it can be a real challenge on the waterfront to get the water from where it exists by nature, what rivers are coming out of, in this case it's the Poudre. And Thornton would like to get this water to the city of Thornton through a pipeline, and they've just been stuck in a permitting process for many years. And you know, we've all probably heard about the challenges of permitting processes for water projects. It's a real serious undertaking and takes a lot of time and money. But another thing I want to bring up also is there's an important consideration when we think about the impact of drying up lands that were previously irrigated agriculture. We've got to think about what are the impacts to Colorado's rural communities, and what does it look like when we dry up historically irrigated lands on a large scale? You know, is that what we want Colorado to look like? We just have questions that we need to ask ourselves. A pretty famous water person, if you're in the water world, is former Supreme Court Justice Gregory Hobbs. And his quote was, "The 21st century is the era of limits made applicable to water decision making due to natural Western water scarcity. We're no longer developing a resource. Instead, we're learning how to share a developed resource." And I think this concept of sharing, although it sounds very, you know, kindergarten teacherish, is something that we really do need to think about when we're talking about developing water projects. You know, everything that we want to do to achieve reliable water supply, it's going to come with trade-offs. We're sharing a limited resource, like Justice Hobbs said, not just among different communities that are growing the population, but with other important needs to the state of Colorado and to our population. So diving a little more into the specifics for Adams and Arapaho counties. There are different types of groundwater in Colorado, both legally and physically. Most of the time, groundwater is physically connected to the streams, and if you were to use a well to pump it, there would be a reduction in stream flow as a result. Tributary groundwater, which is often also alluvial groundwater, is a renewable resource due to the connection of surface water. That's the case for irrigation wells along the South Platte River. However, in some areas, we can pump so much groundwater that it can greatly reduce the flow of our streams. There are some special types of groundwater with little to no interaction with surface water in the stream system. Designated basins are large areas with little surface water. These are indicated by the red dashed lines. What I'm showing here in the map is the entire eastern side of the state of Colorado. So up at the top, that's the northeast corner of Colorado, and down here is the southeast corner. So we've got a big area on our eastern plains that is called designated groundwater. I may have said this before, but designated basins are large areas of little surface water, where the primary water supply is groundwater. There's also another special type of groundwater called non-tributary groundwater. For non-tributary groundwater, there's a physical disconnect between surface water and the groundwater aquifer. So for simplicity, we will include the entire Denver Basin in that category of non-tributary today. And so the Denver Basin is what you see in the middle of that map, that big egg shape with the rainbow colors. And I'm going to zoom in because these are important aquifers for Adams and Arapaho counties. In Adams and Arapaho, we're almost completely underlain by the Denver Basin, again, kind of those rainbow Easter egg colors. On the eastern half, we also have either the Lost Creek or the Kiowa Bijou designated basin. And I'm not going to go into great detail today about why those might be important, but I'd like for you guys to understand that there's unique rules for allocating groundwater use in the designated basins and in the Denver Basin. And in most cases for these, we don't consider impacts to surface water. But for those of you, you know, trying to develop water resources in this area, you're definitely dealing with a patchwork quilt of different regulatory environments. So, you know, am I talking about a location in the Denver Basin or outside of it or in the Denver Basin? Is it tributary groundwater that's connected with surface water or not? So I'm just trying to stress for you all that, you know, perhaps, unfortunately, for those of you doing work across these areas, you might need to be familiar with like a broad range of different bodies of law that guide the use of these different resources. I think that's all the clicks I needed to do there. So the Denver Basin, it's got multiple layers of aquifer formations stacked on top of each other. You can think of them as some nested bowls even, and that's why there were those Easter egg colors on my last map, because the topmost bowl is smaller than the lower bowls, and so these areas outcrop in wider and wider circles, basically. So one thing I would like to explain is how the groundwater in the non-tributary and Denver basins is non-renewable. It's allocated by the quantity of water underlying a particular parcel, and then pumping of that groundwater under the parcel is capped at 1% per year. This is sometimes referred to as the 100-year aquifer life. This is state law that was effective in 1973. More recently, some of the counties, and I think Arapahoe and Adams counties are among them, have put in place local regulations that rather than relying on that 100-year aquifer life for certain types of development, they have stretched that out to something like a 300-year aquifer life. So rather than the allowance to pump 1% per year under your property, in certain counties you may be limited to 1/3 of 1% pumping per year. And that is the idea of, well, let's stretch the use of the limited resource over a longer time period, so it lasts for a longer period of time. But those are local regulations. So this is just a table of water level changes in the Denver Basin, the entire Denver Basin, not just here in Adams and Arapahoe County. And the right-hand column is the change over a 10-year period, recent 10-year period. And if you were to look at those different formations that have 10 or more monitoring wells, you will see that they consistently do have a declining groundwater level. But that's what we would expect, because we're talking about a non-renewable water resource. There's relatively little recharge where water goes into the Denver Basin from precipitation compared to the amount of water that we use. So we do expect that over time we're going to be reducing the amount of water available in these aquifers. So with that in mind, knowing that we are mining this non-renewable resource, many water providers historically who relied on the Denver Basin are making great efforts to reduce their reliance on this non-renewable resource and looking for renewable resources that should supply water to communities and to meet their needs in perpetuity. But as water suppliers shift away from the Denver Basin and look for new water supplies, again, they're faced with those trade-offs and sharing considerations that I was highlighting earlier. These are really difficult decisions, challenging projects, expensive infrastructure, environmental impacts, permitting hurdles. You know, it's a lot, and I probably am preaching to the choir to say that, but I would sure like members of our community to understand why water is expensive, and it's getting more expensive. There's really good reasons why. I'm going to shift gears to the eastern part of the South Cat Basin, and this is east of Adams and Arapahoe counties. And this, what I highlighted here, is the Republican River Basin. It overlies the High Plains Aquifer. A lot of folks know this as the Ogallala Aquifer, and you're probably familiar that this is an aquifer that stretches over much of the central United States. So it, in terms of our country, it's regionally very important. And as you can see on the map, there's a lot of irrigated land in this area. We don't have a whole lot of big developing communities here. We've got the towns of Burlington, we've got Ray and Akron, but we have a whole lot of irrigated agriculture in this area. And this irrigated agriculture is relying primarily on groundwater. You might recall that this is also one of those areas that on a previous map was part of a designated basin called the Northern High Plains Designated Basin. In order to be a designated basin under our law, you primarily have groundwater as your water source. And you're generally far from significant surface water streams. So irrigated ag here is relying on groundwater. Just to, you know, show some more information about what's going on with the aquifer here. This aquifer is not allocated in the same way as the Denver Basin, but it is an aquifer where we've got so many straws in it, pumping a lot of groundwater, that we are drawing down the aquifer levels, as you probably heard, is occurring throughout the entirety of the High Plains aquifer system into Nebraska and across much of the Midwest. So What you see here is 10-year changes in groundwater levels. Red and orange are declining in the last 10 years of more than 10 feet. So again, an area where we're taking more out than is going in at a pace that's not really renewable. This is an area where we don't issue any new well permits, and there is some voluntary conservation occurring, but still, even with that, we're using more than is being replenished. I'm shifting gears a bit now here to jump into our interstate compact, in part because this is relevant to the Republican River Basin. There is a compact for the Republican River Basin that I'm going to talk about today, but we have 9 interstate compacts and 2 international treaties with Mexico. And so what these are is Colorado has signed a contract with our neighboring states, and the contract's been ratified by the United States legislature. And so these compacts allow Colorado to develop a certain amount of water, but they also have obligations for Colorado as the headwater state needs to meet certain things we've agreed to under our compacts for our neighboring states. I do want to point out that Colorado is in compliance with all of our interstate compacts, and we take that pretty seriously, but we are fulfilling all of our obligations under these 9 compacts right now. I'll talk for a little bit about the Republican River Compact. This is an agreement we have with Kansas and Nebraska. It was signed in 1942, and it affects Colorado's ability to pump groundwater within the Republican River Basin in Colorado. We have to do a couple of different things. We have to do a couple of different things under the Republican River Basin Compact. One thing that we need to do is retire 25,000 irrigated acres in the South Fork focus zone of the Republican River by the year 2029. And so that's a lot of acres. Colorado's made some really good progress on this in the last, this requirement was added in 2016. So we've made some really good progress because so far we have retired 11,000 acres in the South Fork focus zone. We have the Republican River Water Conservation District to thank for this to a great extent because it's been a big effort on their part to try to retire these acres. One thing that has helped them a lot is in 2022, the Colorado legislature passed a bill to take $30 million of ARPA funds, give it to the district, and the district does pay farmers with irrigated lands to retire their acreage permanently. So the Republican River Water Conservation District also collects fees from irrigated agriculturalists within the district. So they use those fees along with the $30 million in this program to retire acreage. Another thing that we need to do under the compact is make deliveries of pumped groundwater to the North Fork of the Republican River at the state line. And so we've been doing this also for a number of years. So we are in compliance with this compact, but we do have, kind of a long way still to go to retire the remainder of those 25,000 irrigated acres. I'll switch gears to talk about the South Fork Compact. We have an obligation under the South Fork Compact that we have been managing for about 100 years. This was a compact that was signed in 1923. This first obligation that we have been managing is that during the irrigation season, if flows at the state line of the South Fork drop below 120 cubic feet per second, here within Colorado, and in what they call the lower part of the river, which is from the Washington County line to the east, we need to curtail all water uses that are junior to, I believe it's 1891. So from about Sterling, a little bit east of Sterling, I think it is. When our flows drop below 120 CFS at the state line, we're cutting back water use just in that lower section of the river. And that works fine. It's something that water users have been managing for, like I said, I guess, for about 100 years. There is a new development that you might have heard about on the news. Nebraska recently decided to exercise another provision of the compact called the Perkins County Canal. The Nebraska legislature provided the funds for its design and construction, something on the order of $60 million pretty recently. And so this is actually, the next few slides are actually just slides that I took out of Nebraska DNR slides. But you can see right there at the northeast corner of Colorado, Nebraska will construct a canal that is described in our compact. So again, it's called the Perkins County Canal. Nebraska is planning to construct it, and the allowances for this canal in the compact are that it can divert water during the winter time, during the non-irrigation season, up to 500 cubic feet per second for irrigation uses in Nebraska. There's a little orange star there on the map of where the diversion point would be. It's pretty close to the state line. It's near the town of Ovid. And this canal, like our irrigation season obligation, is only considered senior to water uses east of the Washington County line. So it potentially will end up curtailing water uses, but only in this lower section of the river. And this is with a 1921 priority date. So some of Colorado's water uses in the winter are senior to 1921, but many of them are junior to 1921 and would be affected by the operation of this canal. 500 CFS is a relatively large amount of water. So, you know, why is Nebraska doing this? Because this is a 100-year-old compact, and this provision up until now, I don't know if anybody expected it to actually come to fruition. But again, I'm going to show you some of Nebraska's slides. They point to Colorado's water development. So they point to a number of irrigation wells that exist within this lower section. It's the lower section. It's also what we call Water District 64. If you see that on the map here, Water District 64, that is a section of the river that would be affected by this. We have irrigation wells. We also have what we call recharge areas. We divert water. We put it into basically pits where it percolates into the groundwater and comes back to the river with like different timing. It's sort of a retiming operation, so we get water back in the river at the time that we need it. And then Nebraska's looked at Colorado's plans for water projects into the future, like those that are described in Colorado Water Plan or what we call the Basin Implementation Plans. And Nebraska has seen that they expect flows at the state line to decrease over time. And so this is why they want to construct the canal. I'll just shift gears again. The last compact I wanted to touch on for you all. Colorado River Compact. Well, geez, we're on the east, so why would we care about the Colorado River Compact? But as you probably know, and as I've highlighted here on the map, we have a number of Trans Mountain diversions that take water from the Colorado River Basin and bring it into the South Platte River Basin. And the Colorado River Compact, which involves seven states, including Colorado, it was signed in 1922. And so a lot of these diversions came into operation well after 1922. So there's been a lot of concern, a lot of media attention in the last few years about the water level declines in Lakes Mead and Powell. Our Colorado River Commissioner has pointed out that the upper basin's use has been well within our apportionment. I wanted to read to you guys a quote from a speech that our Colorado River Commissioner gave pretty recently. And some of you might know Becky Mitchell. She was a former director of the state of UCB, and now she's full-time acting as our Colorado River Commissioner. She gave a speech in August at the Colorado Water Congress. The Colorado Water Congress, I guess it was convention, that took place. You can find her speech if you're pretty interested in the Colorado River goings on. There's a website called the Commissioner's Corner. It's a pretty good speech, but I just wanted to read you a short part of it. The subtitle of this section of her speech is Combat Compliance Emphasis. She said, I want to pause here to emphasize something that is so, so important to say. Even in the driest years, the upper division states have never been out of compliance with the compact. We are not even close. If flows at Lee's Ferry fall below 75 million acre feet over a 10-year period, it would prompt an inquiry into the cause. If the cause is something other than our depletion, we have not violated the compact. Remember, we are currently using less than half the flows of the river and less than half of what the compact apportioned to us. My team takes the importance of protecting Colorado's legal interests very seriously. The compact assures us the ability to develop our half of the river into perpetuity at our own pace, without risk of a lower basin giant doubling up our share. I can't say this clearly enough. Colorado is not at risk of compact curtailment. We do ourselves a disservice by suggesting otherwise and play right into the lower basin strategies. So I thought this was a pretty great speech. It was pretty clear because I feel like sometimes the media is pretty concerning and likes to freak everybody out. But this is pretty clear that we're squarely in compliance. We're well below using our allocated apportionment, and we have a contract with six other states that everybody needs to follow. So. I don't think I need to say anything else about Colorado River. So that's the end of my remarks. I just wanted to conclude to say we have a lot of challenges. We're not going to have enough water for everything we want to do in the future. We'll need to be creative, innovative, and hopefully thoughtful about the trade-offs. But I'm hopeful that we will do this. So with that, maybe turn it over to the discussion or however you want to go about it, Kip.
First of all, round of applause.
My head is still spinning. Thank you for putting it on.
She got us her slides late last night, which means she worked like a dog to put this together. So thank you. What struck me when she talked about Adams and Arapahoe County, water being taken out of non-rechargeable aquifers at a rate that is alarming and certainly not good for economic development. To shed more light on that and what can be done in the future, I will turn it over to Arapahoe County. REAP is both in Adams and Arapahoe County. We love working with Adams County. We love working with Arapahoe County. Loretta Daniel from Plant, superstar Loretta Daniel from Arapahoe County Planning, represents Arapahoe County. Arapahoe County is undertaking its own water study. Loretta, do you want to talk, or do you want Will to talk, or how do you wish to proceed in giving an Arapahoe County perspective on all this?
I would defer to Will, since he'll have more technical information and can explain that much better than I can.
I don't know about that. Thanks, Loretta. Well, thanks for the overview. Thanks for lots of good information there on all those water resources, so that's good stuff. I'm Will Coger with Forsman Associates. We're working with some partners, LRE Water and Michael Baker International, on water supply study, and we're approximately halfway through with that. And to give you an update on where we are with that, the whole purpose of the study really is to match the future demands with future supplies and make sure there aren't any gaps that are going to hit us down the road. Right now, Arapahoe County has a population of about 660,000 people. It's projected to be the most populated county by 2050. And we've got some bookends on that growth that could be between 900 to 960,000 people by 2050. So a lot of growth is coming. We've divided the county into three main areas. There's the western part of Arapahoe County, which is largely served by the city of Aurora, and there's also some Denver water connectors. And then in a transitional area is the area of Rangeview Metro District, as you get out, go further to the east. And kind of the central swath of the county is the area where there's a lot of growth projected. There's also a very heavy dependence on Denver Basin groundwater in that region. And so that's the Strasburg, Bennett, Deerfield area. And then further east of there is an area, the third section, and that's really agricultural right now, and as the county wants to preserve it as agricultural, and the water uses aren't expected to change much out that way. Well, there are a lot, there's much that can be done with water efficiency, and in looking at the demands that are associated with that growth, we know that there are there's more opportunities with inclining block rates that can be done as people use more and more water, that once they get into those higher blocks, you're going to pay more money for it. So certainly the ability to charge higher rates for the higher end water users is an important aspect of water efficiency. But also there's much being done these days with using a lot of xeriscaping and actually removing grass areas where it's non-functional turf, and if it's just there for aesthetics, let's use some native grasses there. Let's use xeriscaping and really change the paradigm of what we do right now. As you know, we're all accustomed to bluegrass, but let's do something different and let's make this the landscaping match our environment. So there's much to be done with that. There also is. And we know that more than half of our water use is for landscaping. The Arapahoe County right now is going through a review and an update to their regulations on landscaping. So that'll be an important step going forward. Also, there's much that can be done with reuse. We know that the water that, as Tracy pointed out, the water that's brought over from the West Slope, that is new water to our basin. And then also when you pump Denver Basin groundwater to the surface, that's also new water to the surface system. And so because of that, that water can be fully reused. And there's much opportunities with reuse. In fact, it's a very important part of the supply picture because it's the same, you know, you have that reliability. When you use water and then discharge it, it's a constant supply source, right? You've got that water you've already used. Let's use it again if we can. Rangeview has done tremendous work with an advanced treatment plant to be able to make use of their reuse water. And it's very important, the Prairie Waters Project that Aurora has, where they take water off the South Platte River that is largely effluent many times a year. And they're filtering it in the bank of the river and then taking it down to the Benny Water Treatment Plant for advanced treatment, mixing it with mountain water and providing it to their customers. And so it's a very important indirect reuse system that they have. And they've also expanded the use of that to serve the South Metro area through the what's known as the WISE project, Water Infrastructure and Supply Efficiency Project, serving many of the entities on the South Metro area. So there's a lot that can be done with reuse, and so that's another important part of the equation. There also are many regional cooperative projects that are underway. There's evaluation of using more and more water off the South Platte River, number of storage vessels that are under consideration, storage reservoirs. And so that'll be important for everybody to work together and come up with some regional solutions to providing enough water for the future. As part of our study, LRE Water has prepared a lot of GIS overlays where you can match up what the land uses are with the underlying aquifers and what the model the production rates that we can do with today's technology economically and how much water can be produced realistically. And so that's all part of looking at what the county looks at with respect to the upcoming growth and the approving more subdivisions is matching it up with the actual production abilities of those aquifers. So all in all, it's an exciting time to be in the water business, for sure. Everybody's interested in water, right? So that's good. Okay.
Yep. Thanks, Will. Everyone wants to get in the water business, except price of water's going up, construction costs going up. What do you do in the Eastern Plains? Well, someone who's like doing it now is our next speaker, Mark. Mark Harding, PureCycle. You would know him as the jefe of PureCycle, which is a water technology company, but is now as a developer, master developer of housing neighborhoods, just huge neighborhoods in the REAP realm of Watkins and Bennett. But also, Mark is the smartest guy going out there, no question about it, in terms of development, land use, water use, how it all has to fit together to make anything happen in the Eastern Plains. Mark, give us just your thoughts, your comments, where you think things are headed.
Okay. No discussion about water is easy, right? And reading the room, we've got a lot of elected officials and folks that are, you know, interested in economic development, which needs water resources as a whole. And so let me, you've heard me talk about water systems, our water systems, what we're doing, but let me kind of elevate and talk a little bit globally about some of the challenges that I think we as a water community face. Certainly, Tracy's right. Developing water resources is more complex. Acquiring water resources is more expensive. And each incremental year, those continue to go. They're almost geometric in their scale. And our ability to charge for water is extremely limited, right? The pushback that you get from your customers about their water bill, there's this mentality of it being a right, a natural right to have access to clean water without appreciating what that really means. I mean, for you to have absolute confidence to turn on a tap and know that that's going to be clean drinkable water, fresh, clean drinkable water, is a privilege beyond compare if you take a look at it globally, right? 3/4 of the population of the world doesn't have that luxury. And so that we have that luxury and we waste it is what we need to focus on. Will was right. You know, there's a lot we can do about water conservation. There's a lot we can do about pricing privileges. If you want to waste it, you're really going to pay for it. And to define what that waste is, elected officials, you're the policy directives here. What is it that we should do to help guide that waste? Is it appropriate for us to put that water out on a lawn? You know, you water our lawn, and I often say that's the most expensive piece of art you own because you don't do anything with it. You water it, you cut it, you feed it, you water it, cut it, feed it, over, repeat. Hardly ever play on it. Yes, there are ball fields and parks and open space areas that we can congregate to enjoy that and be able to use that as a common resource as opposed to every individual resource that is underutilized. So some of that will be evolving policy decisions that we make as a community to say we need to redefine our relationship with water. If you look at the space station, they've redefined their relationship with water, right? They don't have any water coming in and they don't have any water going out. And they stay up there for a very long time. So using and reusing our water supplies is going to be part of our future. We'll get over the fact that, you know, it's been through a million kidneys. There's not a glass of water that you haven't had that hasn't already been through a million kidneys. We already have a fixed amount of water on this planet. And it's been around for a very, very long time. And so the amount of fresh water is very small compared to the overall global supply of water. It's less than 3% of the water that is on the planet is available for drinking water. Taking a look at how we look at it in Colorado comparative to other areas, right? If you're on a coast, if you live on a coast, at some price, you can create water. You can desalinate, right? You have a source of water supply that at some price, some technology, some level of effort, you can create new water supply. We don't have that luxury here. We just don't. We're reliant on what Mother Nature gives us, and she's getting a little fickle, right? She gives us a lot in some times and not a lot in other times. And so we need to be understanding how we develop water resources in a changing climate. Climate conditions will always evolve, but how do we as a community be able to adapt to the variability of water supplies in our particular region? We won't have that constant supply, and so that entails focusing our resources on things like storage, things like regional projects. Some of the things that I'm in the water community, and I will tell you, we're terrible at getting along. I mean, if you look at the population of Denver, we have 4.5 million people. I'll just exaggerate, say Denver's a 4.5 million greater Denver metropolitan area. We have over 80 water providers in the Denver metropolitan area. That is one of the most inefficient ways of providing water to 4.5 million people. You couldn't have dreamt up a worse scenario than to have 80 different systems, and 70 of the 80 serve less than 5,000 connections. And so we have all these tiny water systems that got started because they could. They may have gotten started with what water they had available, some wells that were historic wells that were deeded over from an agricultural interest or some Denver Basin water supplies, any number of ways that they got started, and they're out there reaching their limits, you know, and then you get to a financial capacity limit that is almost an impossible nut to cut, because a small district, no water project doesn't come with, you know, a nine-figure number. I mean, there are hundreds of millions of dollar projects. Now they're billion-dollar projects, and no one entity can do it anymore. Not even the big water providers can do it. It's just so expensive to be able to develop them. You know, I'd push back on the state if I had some state legislators here, and I'd say, you know, we need to really work on this 1041 laws. You know, that was something that was enacted for a particular purpose that has evolved to a point where it's so obstructionist in our ability to get the things done that we need to do as a water agency. Some of the things that Tracy was talking about on the regulatory climate and the permitting climate, and communities like the city of Thornton, who have had water since 50-year-old water rights that they've had that they now need to develop, and they can't get them. They can't get the permits to go through there. Not because they don't have the good plan for it, not because they're not mitigating all the impacts from it, but because some of these regulatory climates allow people to be in the way, to be an objector in that. We need to get our arms around that. We need to redefine what the limits are on somebody being able to block a water project like that. Fortunately, there are no state legislators here to throw rocks at me, but that's a tough, tough hurdle for any of these 70 water providers to try and go out and do something when the city of Thornton is one of the big ones. They're a bigger provider, and they can't get it done, let alone anybody else. Can we do better on a cooperative basis? We can do better on a cooperative basis. I sit as the chair of the South Metro Water Supply Authority, right? One of the more innovative groups, right? We pulled together 14 different water providers who were beating each other up every step of the way, either acquiring water rights, developing projects, competing over service areas, any number of areas. 14 of us get together and say, there's got to be a better way. There's got to be a better way. And in fact, developed a project in conjunction with Denver Water, City of Aurora, that enabled us to share in a water project where we've spent about $100 million collectively bringing in a water supply and being able to be cooperative in it rather than competitive in it. It's fair for us to compete to buy the water right, right? It's a private property right. And I will say, state of Colorado has a difficult job, right? Tracy's job is to somehow referee a chaos of a fight amongst all water providers so we don't kill each other. And their job is almost nearly impossible, but they have a good framework. I mean, tip of the spear on being able to protect water right as an asset, as a property right. Colorado does that better than all other places. And so we are doing things right. We have historical protocols, and we have historical protections for water rights that I think allow us to make the billion-dollar investments in these systems that make it work so we can bring water supplies to the urbanized areas. You know, the coexistence between agriculture and municipal. You know, Tracy's slide on, you know, 3% of the overall water use in the state of Colorado is from municipal. That serves our 5.5 million population across the state. 3%. You know, there's a better way. Agriculture can still coexist with M&I interests. They just maybe need to think about how they're using their water supplies. We have a system that incentivizes waste. You know, it's a use it or lose it system. And so, boy, if I'm at risk of losing it, you bet I'm going to use it. Whether I need it or not, I'm going to use it. So let's think about that. Let's think about how we can bring more efficiency into that agricultural system so it's not so, you know, binary, black or white. Either you're using it or I'm using it. Let's all try and use it. Let's use it efficiently. And let's try and use it a bit more differently than we have. So, you know, I just wanted to layer in some of those high-level comments, you know, that really support what the state's looking at and their difficult job of doing it, together with the local agencies trying to figure out, well, how are we going to define, you know, what's an adequate water supply? Is 100 years good? Is 200 years good? Is 300 years good? Do we know what 200 years is going to look like? Are we going to be able to even understand how we're using water in 20 years, much less 300 years? So those are very difficult decisions to wrap around with. And then what you're doing is making a decision on a small entity that doesn't have the resources to deal with the next 5 years, let alone the next 300 years. So those are not easy questions, but those are part of the dialogue when you look at water and how water interacts within land development, agriculture, and amongst and within each of the providers in the metro area. So I'd open it up to questions for Kip or any of the speakers or otherwise.
Before we open it up, Tracy, do you want to respond to anyone? What I want to do is generate a good back and forth.
Yeah, I can talk to you on that. I'm sure, if for no other reason. You know, Mark, I agree with everything you say, and one thing that you brought up is something that I think about a lot when I look at the bigger picture, and I don't know what the answer is, and that was, I think you said 80 water providers in the metro area, 70 of which serve less than 5,000 taps or homes maybe, but how inefficient that seems. And is there any hope? Like, is consolidation a good idea? Does that, I feel like if you work for a particular water provider, that's maybe scary because it's a loss of control. But in my mind, it seems like the efficiency of being able to scale by consolidating systems, building these bigger regional projects, it seems like it makes a lot of sense. It's something sort of out of my wheelhouse. It's truly a curiosity that I wonder about if we could do more with less if we did that.
I would say that, you know, consolidation is probably the only way that these small districts are going to be able to survive. They don't have the financial. I mean, when you break it all down and you get to the nuts and bolts of it, it's a money game. It's a financing game. And to go buy a water right, from the day you buy a water right to the day you sell it to a customer is on average more than 20 years. And so there's no way that a small district can spend a dollar today and not get another dime out of it for 20 years. I mean, it's such a long process and so difficult for communities to be able to find a way that there's a mechanism that they can make that type of investment.
And I think the other way that you see that happen is through maybe less formal coalitions, like you mentioned the South Metro
Water Supply Authority,
and so they work together on a project, and yet you all have you have your own service area that you're responsible for. Yeah, a common project, and we see that in Northern Colorado too. The NIST project, Northern Integrated Supply Project, where you've got, I don't know, I think it's something like 7 Northern Front Range water providers that are coming together with a community reservoir, Glade Reservoir, bringing more water across from the Western Slope. And so these big projects we're able to do when we combine forces, but are we at a place where we should really formally take that to the next step of actual consolidation, and how would that happen? And again, I'm just asking out of curiosity, because I feel like, why aren't we going there? Why aren't we doing this? It seems like it's something we really need to do.
Yeah. I jump in here. Me with a political mind, when I hear 80 water providers, that's 80 little political fiefdoms. Somebody in each of those districts wants to have their little, you know, politics. It's turf, it's ego, and it's money. In this case, not turf, it's water. So there's, how do you break those little fiefdoms for the general good? And it's a political question. It's a human nature question, but I do appreciate that. Mark, you're in the partnership game just like REAP is. You get stuff done by sitting down, partnering with somebody over something to get something done, regardless of what the state says, regulations say. Can you work it out on a realistic basis? Lynn, do you want to jump in with anything here? I catch you off guard, but...
No, you're good. You know, want to speak? I have staff on the map to speak to this.
Cool.
Thank you, staff. You know, you're welcome. I didn't bring Senator Priola. I knew you wanted to say Senator. You know, Senator Priola and I go way back. Our families are both in A. At one point, I thank you so much for your presentation and for your comments. And I'll have the staff member speak, but I would like a follow-up, even if it's on the side, of what does policy look like? And these little fiefdoms that you talk about. And I think our challenge, if I can just speak freely, and I don't know this for a fact, is, you know, as Adams County develops, the concern is, do these water districts have the maintenance and the infrastructure in place? So my background, I came from municipal government, City of Brighton, and the infrastructure investment is a lot, and I just wonder if these water districts take into account all of that moving forward. It's easy to say, yes, we're going to develop, but then all of the existing lines, can they handle the volume? Are they in a space of quality? And that's, it's a different water, you're talking about different water. So the Adams County, we're not a water supplier or wastewater. In the unincorporated areas, we rely on the water district. So I hear you on when it comes to the cost of water. It will still cost our constituents and businesses somewhere down the line, but we're just not the water provider resources. But I'll turn it over to our staff. Thank you so much.
All right. Megan Wilson, I'm a planner for county. And just to kind of add a little bit to that and let you know where we're at, what we're doing, we just wrapped up a water baseline assessment. But it really summarizes everything that Tracy went over. But in, just to kind of piggyback on what you were saying, Mark, is that the county has a total of 76 water providers, specifically within the county. But only 15 of those are really like the largest providers of water in the county itself. So, but just interesting statistics about providers. So. But as we work towards developing our water master plan, which we'll be putting on our IP out for here in the coming months, I was just kind of curious if anyone in Greco County can answer to, like, when you look at changing your regulations, development standards, maybe as far as residential development goes, what other than just zero staking, maybe less, you know, grass, what other changes can be impactful? Because we have so many large PUD developments where, if it gets approved, those PUDs are kind of a free-for-all. They, you know, require 40% of your lawn to be sod or something like that. So I was just curious what other text amendment type changes can we potentially make to have an impact. If there's an answer, it might not be an answer.
Just off the top of my head, From Arapahoe County's perspective, the landscaping here, regulations that we're updating, kind of taking a page from both Aurora and Castlerock in really limiting the turf on single-family detached housing. So that's one of the major things. And then also, too, the whole thing about, well, we don't have a lot of office parks really being developed now because there's kind of a huge demand for office space. But, I mean, there's certainly a lot of turf on those areas. So, to Mark's point about, you know, basically the people's irrigation being used outside, I think that's one of the best actions that a jurisdiction can really take is through those landscaping regulations. The other thing, too, is because we have Sky Ranch and also Prosper, they have zoning approvals for over 12, well, just around 12,000 single-family or residential units, I should say. So those would be either single-family detached, which they most likely will be, or town homes, or maybe multi-family, and up to 10 million square feet of commercial. So those are big projects, you know, where you're forecasting population about 35,000 and those two master plan units. Now, of course, Sky Ranch, of course, has Greenview and Pure Cycle, basically, so they have a very sustainable approach to water. Prosper, the first phase was approved on groundwater, so that was 9,000 residential units approved on groundwater. But the Board of County Commissioners said, when you come back for subsequent phases for approval, you'll need to have a sustainable approach. So, I mean, that's what we've done to date. We're aware that there are some subdivisions, older subdivisions within Arapahoe County, that are on wells that are having problems with water. So they'll have to look for other approaches to have a more sustainable system. And that's the thing that people come up for a water study is how we're going to deal with smaller and medium-sized subdivisions and an option to the property owners individual wells.
I might layer in just on that one as well, you know, because we're a developer as well. From a land use standpoint, while Loretta is right, you take a look at your landscaping requirements, but some of the other things that we find attractive, and I think Arapahoe's got right, are when you take a look at lots, individual lots, and building envelopes within lots, setback requirements become really important, right? So the smaller you have on setback requirements, the more density you can get, you know, you lower that that outdoor area that you have to do something with, whether that's to be turf or whether that's to be xeriscape. But, you know, we have a multitude of challenges, housing affordability being one, that, you know, we want to still want detached single family house options, but when you have 12-foot setbacks from each of the lot lines, you know, the density requirements in there don't allow you to have a sustainable model for affordability on that. You gobble up too much land, I guess is my point, where you can be more efficient with the same size house on a smaller lot with the smaller water requirement. And so they all kind of coexist within how you address not just water, but, you know, growth and housing and affordability. And so, you know, we really do appreciate Arapahoe County's forward look to say, you know, those areas that we are going to develop, we want to develop at a higher density. And, you know, I know people sort of say, hey, geez, I don't want to stand between two houses and touch both houses, as compared to not standing in a house at all. So, you know, you just kind of redefine those relationships and how that next area of growth occurs and how the innovation in land use and land development occur with more pocket parks where there are common areas that people can congregate to, and you get more use out of that as opposed to every individual house having to have their own park, those sorts of things.
I might ask a question. Just this discussion reminded me of the governor's staff this year came up with a land use bill. I don't know if any of you paid attention to that. It was really met with a lot of skepticism. But one thing, you know, that we took note of at the engineer's office is a concept of allowing. I think they call it middle housing. I'm getting out of my lane for sure here. But middle housing, where you could, on your single family lot, you could construct an accessory dwelling unit or like a second place for people to live. And, you know, I got conflicted. That makes sense. Like, would that take out bond? Would that, you know, the governor's got a really big priority for affordable housing, and there's not enough housing for Colorado. And so, truly a question for you all, does that make any sense in our older neighborhoods with bigger lots to add in, you know, another unit on somebody's existing lot? I'm sure from an infrastructure perspective, is that pipe in the street even have the water for those people and the sewer, et cetera. But is that any part of the solution here? It's a question for you all.
Boy, I can give you my two cents on it. And going through any, you know, we have I'll say it's a large master plan, right? When you talk about 5,000 residential equivalent units, we probably have 3,400 residential units, a couple million square feet that convert into that. And the reason housing costs so much is there's a lot to it. When you go through and you deal with traffic and you deal with lights and you deal with school capacities and stormwater drainage capacities, that's all based on a certain amount of density. And so retrofitting that, I think the government proposal had the right aspirations, but to drop that on to a city who's already trying to deal with all those issues, and then now you may have, oh gosh, I don't have enough park space, or I don't have enough school space, or I don't have enough of all this other stuff. You know, I very highly encourage density. You know, I take a look at Scottsdale if you want to tour it. You know, it's a high density, not high density. You know, when you have 3.5, on average, 3.5, 4 units to the acre, that's not high density. You know, 20 units to the acre, multifamily, is high density. But when you still have detached housing that can be in a smaller footprint, and then you free up some other areas within your community to have common space areas, whether those are going to be trails or parks or open space areas or community amenities, all those other things, those are shared assets that you can use. And so I would say the governor's aspirations are correct. You know, I think the community's heard that we want more density, so maybe they can work on more density without having it be plopped into an area that wasn't actually set up that way. That would be my only comment.
Gentleman back there had a question, your hand up.
Yeah, I come from a different standpoint from what you guys are talking. I look at readers. I'm putting in a installation in a town here in Eastern Colorado that will provide, they can meet that Reg 84 reuse. And you hear an awful lot about reuse right now, that, you know, throw out the faucet, people have a hard time with that. But like you said, you know, the south, but every drain we have, somebody upstream is dumped their wastewater into that stream.
You might have a better advantage than maybe Louisiana.
Yeah. But anyway, that's why I just came here to see if there's going to be increased value put on reuse. This town I'm working with, they see it as a multi-million dollar savings to them, and actually added value to do this. Because also I'm through the, I think it's a Lost Creek drainage, and you know, that's money. And, anyway, in rural Colorado, there are different issues than what you guys have here along the front range, but it's still the same. You know, when they pump through fresh water, it comes out of an aquifer, more than likely. So I didn't know if you had any insight into where reuse is going to go in the state.
Well, we have two. We have one, but two zero discharge wastewater reclamation facilities. So we're reusing 100% of the water supply that we treat from our community.
Did you get pushback from the water district because of augmentation?
Well, we are the water district, so we, you know, and yeah, you sometimes reuse water is used for augmentation of other water supplies, and that's a indirect way of reusing your water supply, and then a direct way is to be able to bring it back into your system and have a non-potable reuse system. So we have purple pipe systems, and those are very prevalent. You see purple hydrants out there. Most parks, you'll see a purple sign out there that says this is reused water. And then, you know, within, I'm telling you, within 20 years, we'll be space station oriented. We'll have direct potable reuse. And so, it, you know, whether you have an environmental buffer in there or a storage buffer in there or anything else, you know, that's we'll be doing that. We'll be reusing our water supplies to their fullest maximum extent.
I guess I have a question about that. I always understood that a big challenge in Colorado, at least, was you generate a brine or some kind of discharge with the qualities that can't easily be discharged through the stream system as a result of your treatment. And is that a barrier?
So you can. It depends on how some of that brine is actually contained in a solid portion of that. So that goes offsite for offsite soil enhancement uses for that. Depends on the input source of water supply. So water quality, not only is it getting more scarce, but it's getting dirtier. We have more stuff in it. And so, you know, the TES load, you kind of watch that. And you know, taking out salts gives you that brine, and there's not a good way to get rid of salts. There's no good use for salts. That's what you need. If anybody wants innovation, find a good use for salt. But that's a disposal issue, and South Metro has some of that stuff, and we're dealing with other projects other than the WISE project, because we are working on more regional projects, and they're delivering water supplies that we may need to treat and get rid of some brines. Because that water source may come in at, you know, 1500 TDS. We want to take it down to 500 TDS, or else all you guys are going to be on the phone calling and saying my water tastes funny today. So how do you deal with those and making sure that we have a system of doing that? And it's not easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Other questions, comments?
I was just going to mention that 90% really captured me as well. It's like a lot of the options we're talking about, whether it's decreasing landscaping and usage or increasing density, it just feels like that 7% and like moving the mark on that. Like if we move half of the amount of water that we're using municipally, right, 3.5. If we do 100% of that, we moved it from 7 to 0. So like in my mind, being like, what is the pressure? What is happening in the agricultural use that is pushing them to decrease that 90% of usage? And I don't know if anyone's familiar with that. I can speak to like what are the options there and how much is being kind of pushed against them to bring that number down.
I can say that there's been a real strong movement to sprinklers, of course, but now they've gone to wobblers. We used to run pivots with impact, we lose a lot of water. We cut our water use by probably 60%, you know, change the rods. And it's more efficient. And so that's what agriculture, not everybody does that yet, but that's what it has to do. We've got to put a minimum amount of water, what it takes, and we've got to eliminate wind, evaporation, things like that. That's really all that has to do. And then ditch irrigation, we've got to go with it. That is the most inefficient way to irrigate.
And it seems like there's, from fairly limited knowledge, a lot of like inefficient practices that are just literally done in even potentially inefficient crops for this area that do not want to grow in this area. And I don't know what options or what's being discussed with like local neighbors and agriculture of saying, why are we trying to grow something here that we have to put this much effort, this much water, this much work into it? It doesn't want to grow here and we can trade that with other crops or but yeah, it seems like there's really opportunities. Obviously, they're costly and they take work and you do it at a very large scale, but like there are options, and how much are we putting onto individuals to absorb the responsibility and have two dwelling units on your 5,000 square foot lot when we have these options available for a 90% user?
some of those innovations are just what you're talking about, where a water provider will go into a ditch system and offer the ability to get rid of flood fallowing and say, okay, we'll sprinkle this, we'll pay for that investment. And the efficiencies of some of that water use, we want to take back as a compensation for investment into those irrigation systems. It's a win-win. They get to keep growing, you get water supply out of it, and it's not a binary, you know, our wins, your loss.
Yeah, we're super, you know, de-incentivized. Like, I know in our town kind of got it, like, we raise cold water like a ton. Like, we are. If you want to waste it, you are going to pay for it. But how does that translate then to agriculture? If you want to waste it, you are going to pay for it. And are they having a similar pressure, even just by the cost of what that water is, to invest and make more efficient practices? Because it's a cost saving to them ultimately, but if they're not incentivized to do it because they're not having to pay to waste, what's their incentive to do that?
And the financial structure of the family farmer is incredibly complicated.
Sure.
And it's not really a profitable business, it's a lifestyle. And so there are subsidies and programs that allow you to use sprinklers. But it's not, I wouldn't say that it's just families going, yeah, we just want to waste because we have to waste. But
sure,
it's cost prohibitive to do a lot of these investments on like the individual farm basis without knowing. I definitely have heard of PureCycle in like the Arkansas Valley River area. It's an incredibly complicated piece that, to your point though, if that's the largest consumption of water, we do need to take a look at it. But there's a lot of challenges from the small like family farm perspective, for sure.
Can I jump in here real quick? We haven't gone around the room. Tracy, you need to know who these smart people are in the room. Sherry, will you lead us up?
Sherry James, REAP Administrative Officer.
Stephen Vetter, I'm with the I-70 Scout in Eastern Colorado News and Newspaper out of Strasburg. Dan Hoff, Superintendent of Schools in Strasburg.
Justin Ryer, Beacon Real Estate Services, working on land development and occasionally selling a farm.
Amy Cole with the Board Chamber of Commerce.
Lynn Baca, I'm the County Commissioner.
Jane Herring, Civic House Group Services.
Do you want the smart people or do you want me to?
You too.
Rich Cooler, Civic House Group.
Will Cover, Fortune Associates.
Sarah Ryan, Capital Sports Group Associates.
Loretta Daniel, Arapo Family Planner.
Crystal Lamb with the Department of Local Affairs.
Lauren Wash, family farm, developer, I developed 1,000 units, Strasburg. Gary May, May Farms and Fires, Colorado.
Holly Swain, May Farms, Fires.
Michael Collett, Farmers of Merchants Bank.
James Smith, 762.
Stephen Ross, Adams County Economic Development.
Kevin Martin, County Bank Trustee.
Samantha McGree, Town of Community Development.
Bob Hastings, definitely retired, but used to manage a water system in Hawaii. Hi, Mark.
Nick Eagleson, I'm a town fan.
Thank you all for coming. I hear all the talk here, and it's apparent to me that as you go forward in public policy, no longer is it housing development or deal with water, or ag or deal with water. It all has to now work together. Economic development and community development and park and open space and housing and ag, all has to have water integrated into its future planning, because it just has to all work together from now on, because we have such a depleted a source of water in the future. Tracy, question for you, something that's I've really been interested in. You're queen of aquifers. You know all about aquifers. How do aquifers get measured at any point in time? And over time, the topography, do aquifers change in direction and flow? The reason I ask this is it seems to be such an important question. If you're going to build something and you need to know the price of water, well, it's a supply and demand thing, but the supply is in an aquifer, and people may have a difference of opinion of how big that aquifer supply is. So can you riff a little bit about aquifers and how they're measured and when they're measured and who measures them And does it jive with other people who are measuring aquifers?
Yeah, I'm trying to talk about that. I'm not a hydrogeologist who are the scientists who are most knowledgeable about what's happening under our feet. But in terms of the question of measurement, I'll let you know that the state of Colorado does have a groundwater measurement program that's statewide. And so twice a year, usually our staff goes out and take, like, essentially a big tape measure, sticks it down a well, and measures the depths to water. And so when you're tracking that over time, that's how we were able to provide the data about the change in water levels. And so that's basically, okay, the water level dropping. But then the other question is, well, how much water is there left? What's the quantity? You know, and so there's a measure called saturated thickness. That's like how many feet of wet water is there within an aquifer, and then you can calculate a volume amount based on that once you know an area.
So wet water? What does that
mean? Yeah, sorry, that didn't really mean anything. Water. Sometimes in the water world, we'll say wet water because some things we account for on paper, which is water that you don't really
paper
need
water to see. Versus wet water.
Yeah, but that didn't really make any sense.
Okay.
So, you know, how many feet in your formation is filled with water, and then what is the volume? So you can make those calculations when you know where the bottom of the formation is and where the water level is, and then you know some of that depth is full of material, right? Your sands and clays, and then some of it is actually water. So some portion of that depth of water actually is water and not the formation itself, so water that you might be able to extract. So you do that kind of calculation. But I feel like I didn't fully answer your question. That's how you measure and estimate the quantity that's there.
I've come across some conversations where some people have a different measurement of the aquifer, or a different prediction of aquifer mm-hmm. supply than someone else. And my question is, aren't you measuring the same thing? Shouldn't you be getting the same results? And maybe the answer is no, depending on how you measure, where you measure, what technology you use to measure. Am I off base, or is that a realistic description?
I think it's realistic that people might have different estimates because the aquifer characteristics, the characteristics of the material where the water is stored, they're just estimates based on, like, well, we actually took a sample at this one location and another location, and we're going to average it, or we're going to make an estimate. So because you can't take a sample from every single location, you are always making an estimate. But, you know, I don't know if anyone else in here is a hydrogeologist that would have a different explanation than that.
That's great to me. Anybody else with that? Mark, back to you. Assuming we did have state policymakers in the room, you mentioned the 1041. Oh, big bad 1041. What needs to be changed in state water policy to accomplish anything we have as aspirations in this room today?
That'd be one. You know, I mean.
Meaning what?
They need to put some limits. They need to put some limits on it. So I'll give you my best historical perspective on 1041s. Back in the 80s, there was a water provider who shall not be named, was looking at developing a water reservoir in Vail, outside of Vail, in a pretty area, a gorgeous area. And Vail did not want that to happen. And they had acquired the land, they had the ability to do it, and they wanted to move forward with it. And influential parties went to the legislature and said, okay, we need the ability to establish what was to be defined as an environmental standard for water projects.
that somebody should adhere to. And so they enacted this legislation, and it was Senate Bill 1041. And since then, it's been, because it was so short in its language, it had broad interpretation about what it could and could not do. And, you know, to date, it has not been to the Supreme Court. And I'm betting that Gorton will have to take it to the Supreme Court. But at the end of the day, what it has allowed every jurisdiction that a project goes through is to have an absolute veto to say no. And they can justify it any way they want. And so then it's now used as a tool to extract something from a project. And that's just not what it was intended to do. It was intended to be an environmental protection, and it's now a regulatory bludgeon. And it's the third rail of politics. No one wants to touch it.
Tracy, any comment on that, or do you kind of agree with that, or?
Yeah, that, I don't know anything really about it other than I have seen it be a major barrier to water projects, but, you know, I would think that counties, on the other hand, might like that they can be watchdogs or whatever you might call it over a project happening in their jurisdiction. That's my personal opinion. I
Any comment from the county on how if we're going to get bludgeoned?
It's not used all that often because it's usually not that many major projects that come through. So I haven't been with the county long enough. I've only been with the county for 4 years. So I was a municipal planner before, so I was 1041. So I can't really speak to it.
Great. Cool. Any other thoughts from the audience about anything at all? We'll wrap up here in a minute. It's been a great question, by the way.
Tracy, these are the superstars from Bennett over here. They figured out water, wastewater, growth, retail development.
Sure we
figured
have.
Figured out.
Sure we have.
Well, they haven't stopped.
Now we stop like the boot.
But it always struck me that Bennett is on some kind of right path with how it all fits, has to fit together. So kudos to you guys. You really are, you know, the spotlight is on you guys. Thank you all, one and all, for coming. Tracy, thank you so very much. You're super duper busy. But, you know, the audience you get are people who take this back home and try to figure out new ways of agriculture, new ways of housing, new ways of education. You have a superintendent here. I mean, he's trying to figure out, you know, new school buildings in the future. Does every school building need a toilet?
no grass.
Another example, Byers High School, I like to use this example. Byers High School replaced their football field with artificial turf. Hip hip hooray, water saving, blah blah blah. Byers Water District goes, oh no, we just lost 6% of revenue because of so how does all that work? So Superintendent, thank you very much for coming. I think we are honored to have you. And water affects what he does as well. So no further questions. Thank you all. Reap, by the way, commercial time, regional and economic advancement partnership. We exist to hold these kind of events. We agitate, we advocate, we organize, we do anything for the benefit of the quality of life and economic development along the I-70 corridor. We're always searching for members, new members. If you sign up for today, you'll hear from me with a membership request. Tell your friends, tell your neighbors. In 2024, we wish to continue conversations and dialogues on water and other kind of cutting edge issues that are going on in our corridor. So thank you again, one and all. We are adjourned.
Sure.